Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. Have you ever stood beneath a dark night sky in summer, looked up at the myriad of stars in the Milky Way, and wondered, are there planets like ours out there? And if so, is there life on them? For centuries, these questions were as unanswerable as they were universal. But in the past few decades, the search for exoplanets, planets beyond our solar system, has gone from a fringe area of astronomy into the mainstream of science. Thanks to the Kepler Orbiting Telescope, thousands of exoplanets have been discovered and many have been categorized. It seems that planetary systems around other stars are the rule and not the exception. So in this program, we're going to take a look at the exciting work being done to make the realm of science fiction one of science reality. Later on in the show, we'll talk to Arielle Samuelson. She's the web manager who helped plan and produce the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's Exoplanet Travel Bureau. There, you can immerse yourself in 360-degree panoramas of alien landscapes based on the latest scientific findings. But first, we're joined by Eric Mamajek. Eric is the Deputy Project Scientist for the Exoplanet Exploration Program at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. He joins us via Skype. Eric Mamajek, welcome to Blue Dot. First, I'd like to get to know a little bit about yourself. Tell us about how you first got interested in astronomy and science in general, and then how you got interested in exoplanets and working on that.
I've been interested in science since I was a little kid. I saw Mount St. Helens the year after it blew up in the early 80s. That got me interested in science. And shortly thereafter, I remember seeing these images from NASA, from the robot explorers, the Voyager probes that were visiting the outer planets in the solar system. All these beautiful images from Jupiter and Saturn, Uranus and Neptune. And that really sort of iced my interest in space. And here we are decades later and looking at trying to explore what worlds are like orbiting other stars. So it's been a great run.
And while I know this isn't your particular area of expertise, we recently heard news that the Curiosity rover has detected organic molecules, the building blocks of life on Mars. And I'd like to know what your take is on that.
I'm not too surprised. I think the organic materials are throughout the solar system. I think it was just a matter of time before we were finding them in the surface of Mars, and hopefully there's more further under the surface. So there may be areas where there's more organic chemicals near the surface than others, and we'll see if it ends up being an indicator that there was a past life on the planet. But there's still a lot more investigating that needs to be done. The other big signal was the methane, the variations in the methane abundance in the atmosphere. That's very interesting. We need to track down whether that's due to something biological or probably something much more mundane.
So definitely interesting, but not like some in the media have reported that this is evidence for life on Mars. But it is tantalizing, isn't it?
It's yet another tantalizing clue, and we need to understand Mars's history and its geology a lot better, and we need to explore more of the surface and try to piece together its past.
Well, let's talk about your area of expertise, exoplanets, planets beyond our solar system, because now we know of thousands of them. We have some programming coming up on Kepler, so I don't want to get too into that mission, but I would like you to give us an overview of the history of detecting exoplanets and where we are now with the launch of TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, earlier this year.
It's hard to believe it's only been the last three decades that we've known for sure that there are planets orbiting other stars. And, you know, growing up in the 80s, there was speculation that planets were probably common in the universe. And it's been interesting to see the development of this field over the last few decades. And they're very tough to detect. Planets, compared to their stars, they're much lower in mass and they're much smaller in their size. And that makes them difficult to detect, both from their gravitational influence, from detecting, you know, any light coming from them, or their ability to block out the light from stars. And so there's been a variety of techniques that have been used, some of the most successful ones have been Doppler shift, looking at the blue shift and red shift due to the effects of gravity tugging on a star, causing its lines to move back and forth. With Kepler launching in the late 2000s, the technique that's been most successful has been looking for variations in the light of stars when a planet passes in front of them. So if a Jupiter-sized planet, a big planet, passes in front of a star like the Sun, it blocks out about 1% of the light. We can detect that. We can detect that with ground-based telescopes now. When a little planet like Earth passes in front of a star like the Sun, it's about a 1 part in 10,000 signal. That's much more difficult. You need to go to space to detect that. You need space telescopes. And so Kepler has now detected a few thousand planets and candidates. They're not all confirmed. We need further follow-up, further observations to follow them up. And so the interesting thing now in 2018 is we can now statistically say that planets are very common. Probably most of the stars you see in the night sky likely have not only a planet, but probably planets around them. And in terms of planets that might be like Earth, similar in size, similar in how much radiation they get from their star, you know, in the sort of temperate zones where temperatures might be okay for life, at least something like about 20% of stars probably have a planet similar in size to Earth in a region around their star where the temperatures might be conducive to life. That's remarkable because there's hundreds of billions of stars in our Milky Way. There's hundreds of billions of galaxies. There's probably trillions of planets like Earth out there. And when we say like Earth, at least similar in size and atmosphere. And so there's going to be a lot to study in the future. TESS just launched in April. TESS is the Transiting Exoplanet Survey satellite. It's going to pick up where Kepler has left off, and it's going to map most of the sky looking for planets that pass in front of their stars for many of the brightest and nearest stars in our Milky Way. And so there should be thousands more planets detected with TESS.
And then the next big weapon you will have in your arsenal is the James Webb Space Telescope, the successor to Hubble. What kinds of things will it be capable of doing when it comes to observing and studying exoplanets?
So the big thing James Webb is going to help us with is trying to characterize the atmospheres of these planets. So TESS is a smaller mission that's going to help us find the targets. It's going to help us find the small Earth-sized planets. And you can almost think of it as a finderscope for James Webb. James Webb is going to try to measure the spectral signatures of these planets passing in front of their stars. And what those spectra are going to tell us is about the chemical composition of those atmospheres, how much of certain types of molecules are in those atmospheres. So James Webb will be sort of sniffing the atmospheres of these planets. But you need a very big telescope, and James Webb is going to help us do that in the infrared. So we're excited with TESS launching. We hope that TESS provides many more new, interesting exoplanet targets. And then when James Webb eventually launches, there'll be several years where astronomers will be trying to observe the very most interesting targets that were detected with TESS, but also K2 and Kepler and some of the other projects.
Cool. Let's move on. I'd like to play Star Trek with you a little bit. When the Enterprise would enter a new system, you would hear them say, "This is a Class M planet," or whatever. Give us an overview of the zoo, the menagerie of exoplanets. What are the most common types of worlds out there, as well as the unusual ones? Can you give us a sense of that?
I would say I'd start off with that one of the biggest surprises of the last several years, and this comes from the Kepler mission, is that the most abundant type of planets we're detecting are actually two types of planets we don't have in our own solar system. And they've sort of broken up into two categories. One's called super-Earths, and one's called sub-Neptunes. In our solar system, we really don't have anything intermediate in size between our Earth and Neptune. Neptunes and Uranus are both about four times the size of the Earth and about 15 times the mass. And it seems that planets intermediate in size between those two are very common in our galaxy. And we think that sub-Neptunes have thick hydrogen helium rich atmospheres similar to Uranus and Neptune. They're just smaller versions. The sub-Earths, we don't know. The sub-Earths could be super-Earths could be a wide range. They could be things like Earth that are mostly rock with some ocean. There could be planets that are totally ocean-dominated. There could be ones that are mostly very dense iron and nickel dominated. And so far, for the planets where we can actually measure their densities and try to constrain their compositions, there seems to be a wide variety of densities. So we think there's going to be a zoo just in that one category of super Earths, things that are sort of in the 1 to 2 times the Earth radius range. We've been detecting Jupiter-like planets for a few decades now, and we now know that planets like Jupiter are fairly common. They're probably around at least a quarter of the stars in the sky. And we're finding lots of Neptune-sized planets, things that are, you know, tens of times the mass of the Earth. And we're also finding them in weird places. We're finding these planets orbiting very, very close to their star. Some of them are receiving thousands of times as much radiation as the Earth receives, and the atmospheres of these temperatures are thousands of degrees. And we're also finding, you know, Jupiter-sized planets that orbit hundreds of astronomical units, you know, billions of kilometers away from their star. It's not clear how they got there. Did they form out there? Were they stripped from another neighboring star? We're also finding, one of the big surprises is we're finding that some of the planetary systems are very compact. We have found evidence of systems that have, you know, a handful of planets all orbiting closer in than Mercury is in our own solar system. They're all very, very close to each other. You know, some of these, if you were on one of those planets and you looked up, you'd see multiple things that look like our moon in different phases, and they're actually different planets in those systems. So we're finding there's a real zoo of planets out there, and they're not all, we don't have those examples. We don't have examples of some of those in our own solar system.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlohm. After a short break, we'll return to our look at exoplanets worlds beyond the solar system with Eric Mamajek from the Jet Propulsion Lab's Exoplanet Exploration Program. Stay with us. And we're back. Thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return to our conversation with Eric Mamajek, Deputy Project Scientist for the Exoplanet Exploration Program at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So when we look at our own solar system and how it's organized with the inner terrestrial planets made of rock, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, and then the outer gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and then the Kuiper Belt icy dwarf planets like Pluto, is the solar system kind of weird compared to what we're observing around other stars?
That's a big question. One of the issues now is that we have multiple techniques that are probing these systems that are able to find these planets, but they all have strengths for finding planets in certain size ranges and at certain orbital ranges. So we don't have complete pictures of these planetary systems yet. What Kepler is providing us is a lot of information about what is common for planets orbiting close in around stars. The other techniques are probing other ranges. So we really don't have a complete picture of a lot of these planetary systems. So it's not clear yet how common our system is. What is clear is that there are a lot of systems out there that are much more compact, where there's a lot of planets, there's a lot of mass in planets, and sometimes even giant planets orbiting closer in than Mercury is in our own solar system. There's also, you know, systems that are that seem to be very empty close in. So we're not sure yet. I think as time goes on and we have a few results from a few new types of surveys, things like TESS and WFIRST, new surveys from using ground-based telescopes, I think we're going to fill in a lot of the details. And maybe in about a decade, I think we'll have a fuller picture on how similar our system is to compared to other exoplanets. We will say just off the bat, about half of the stars out there are stellar multiples. They have second, third, sometimes even fourth stars in the system. We orbit a system with just one star. So that will change the geometry right there.
And of course, that brings to mind the famous scene from Star Wars featuring the sky of Tatooine.
Yeah, that could just as easily be taken from our nearest stellar neighbor. The Alpha Centauri system has three stars in it, and two of them are similar to the sun, just lying four light years away. So if there's planets orbiting Alpha Centauri A and B, they may get a scene similar to Tatooine.
Wow, what's the closest analog we've seen in our catalog of exoplanets compiled by Kepler to an Earth 2.0, a planet like Earth? What's the most analogous world we've detected yet, or worlds that seem to be perhaps like Earth?
Well, there's planets that are similar in size and similar in how much light they're receiving from their star. Some of those are sort of right near the edge of the detection limits for Kepler. And so there's some controversy as to whether they'll survive further statistical analysis. So there's ones like Kepler 452b and Kepler 444 and some others. So there have been some Kepler candidate planets that are sort of just starting to reach the sizes of planets like Earth. You have to remember Kepler, the original Kepler survey lasted a few years, and so it was able to detect planets that transited their star more than maybe two or three times before they were able to statistically say for sure, or fairly sure, whether they thought the planet was real or not. And so they were very good at detecting planets very close in, orbiting their star on the orders of days and weeks and months. But it started to become more difficult to detect things with orbital periods similar to the Earth on the order of 1 year. We also know, I should say, that the nearest star, Proxima Centauri, there was a report that came out a couple years ago. There was a detection of a signal due to the gravitational effects of a planet orbiting the very nearest star. Proxima Centauri is about four light years away. The star is only about a tenth of the mass of the sun, maybe about a thousandth of the sun's luminosity. So it's a dim red dwarf that flares often. But it looks like there's a planet a little bit bigger than Earth orbiting that star about every 2 weeks. So it's interesting that our nearest stellar neighbor probably has a planet similar in size to Earth.
And these planetary systems, if they're in any way similar to ours, there must be moons around many of the exoplanets. And in our own solar system, we found that the conditions for life probably exist in the icy ocean moons of the outer solar system. So has there been much emphasis on searching for exoplanets? Is that like a hot thing for the future?
Eventually, there have been some efforts to look for exo moons. There have been some tantalizing clues. We're also starting to detect disks of material around young gas giant planets, and those disks probably turn, you know, some of that mass probably goes into forming moons. But the signal is going to be much more difficult to detect in terms of detecting things like the moons in our solar system. They're just so much more, so much smaller in mass and size. But in the coming decades, we'll probably have better evidence for those. Giant planets, you know, like Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, they seem to be very common. In our own solar system, it seems the process that spawned those giant planets also seem to like forming moons. They each have dozens of moons and typically have multiple large moons similar in size to ours, thousands of kilometers across. Titan around Saturn has its own thick nitrogen atmosphere and seas of methane. There's probably a wide variety of environments on those moons. And maybe for some of the larger planets, you know, when we start getting up to on the order of 10 times the mass of Jupiter, the masses of those disks that form those moons, maybe you start forming larger moons, things that are starting to get on the order of the size of Mars or maybe even Earth. And even if they're far away from a star, they may be tidally heated. We see this in our own solar system. The moons of Jupiter, their gravity tugs on each other, and the tidal forces from Jupiter pull and stretch these moons and actually contribute to their heat. And they can produce volcanism. They can produce more internal heat than heat that they're getting from their star. So we talk about habitable zones and, you know, these temperate zones around stars where you'd like to put an Earth-like planet and it would receive enough light to support liquid water at the surface and maybe life. But there may be other types of habitable zones. We may have it in our own solar system. There may be seas under the ocean, under the surface of moons like Europa around Jupiter, or Enceladus orbiting Saturn. So that we need to explore our own solar system and see whether some of the icy moons in the outer solar system perhaps are able to support life. We may be able to address that in the coming decade or two. And boy, if there's life under the sea, under the icy crust of places like Europa and Enceladus, those conditions are probably similar to those on, you know, trillions of moons orbiting trillions of planets orbiting other stars in the Milky Way. So it's going to be interesting to see how the next few decades of exploration unfold.
Well, finally, you're a scientist and you must pore over immense amounts of data in front of a screen for hours and hours. But do you find yourself at times using your imagination and wondering what these worlds would be like to visit and what kind of alien life forms could possibly be living out there?
You always wish you had a bigger telescope to see a little deeper than we currently can. And you sometimes wish you were an astronomer decades in the future using telescopes and technologies that we don't currently have. It's been amazing how fast this field has moved in the last few decades. You know, that now we can say that planets are common around other stars. And so, you know, one of the challenges of the next generation is to figure out, is life common on planets orbiting other stars? And your imagination runs wild sometimes. And I think we need to be prepared for the unexpected. Astronomy is one of those fields that keeps delivering surprises every time we build a new telescope or build a new type of instrument. There's always new discoveries, things we weren't expecting. Nature is much more inventive than the human imagination, and we're seeing that with exoplanets. And so we'll continue to be surprised and hope that. Eventually, we'll have some answers in the future on some of the big questions like, are we alone and does life develop elsewhere on other planets?
Well, we need to let you go. But before we do, real quick, could you give us your elevator speech about what you do and why you love doing it?
It's great to go to work every day knowing that there's a chance that some great discovery is just waiting to be made. And astronomy has just kept delivering over and over some very interesting surprises. We're learning new things about the universe all the time, and sometimes it's difficult to keep up with all the new discoveries. And it's great to see the field changing so quickly. There's a lot of people participating in and making these great discoveries, and it's great to know that you're working on addressing some of the big questions. You know, are we alone? Are there other planets like Earth out there? And it's very exciting to work on that and to help in helping the nation. On this path of discovery, to discover new worlds and to characterize them.
Okay, well, on that note, we're going to say goodbye and thank you, Eric Mamajek, for sharing your incredible knowledge about exoplanets, the planets beyond our solar system. Thanks to our guest, Eric Mamajek, Deputy Project Scientist for the Exoplanet Exploration Program for NASA JPL. Next, we're going to visit with Ariel Samuelson. Ariel manages the website for the whimsically named Exoplanet Travel Bureau. And while you can't book a flight on a starship to the TRAPPIST-1 system, you can take a virtual journey there and many other worlds thanks to the work of artists and scientists and web programmers like Ariel. She joins us to talk about it via Skype from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Ariel Samuelson, welcome to Blue Dot. Well, Ariel Samuelson, you are the web editor and social media lead for the Exoplanet Exploration Program at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Is that right?
That is correct.
And you're in charge of the web presence that is the Exoplanet Travel Bureau, and that's just newly launched. And am I right there, too?
Yes, we just rolled out the Exoplanet Travel Bureau. We've had the posters for a little bit, but now we have a full experience.
Yeah, I had the TRAPPIST-1E poster that I got for my science classroom like a year or so ago, and it's really beautiful. I'd like you to begin by talking a little bit to us about what was the genesis of this idea to create a travel bureau for exoplanets?
It's actually a pretty fun origin story because I work in the Exoplanet Exploration Office, and we were looking for something to decorate the office. So we decided to do these travel posters that were these vintage style, inspired by the WPA posters from the 1930s and 40s, where they revealed these wondrous places throughout America so that people in America could use their imaginations to feel like they were there. And we thought that was perfect because we wanted to encourage all people all over the world, not just in our country, to imagine these wondrous places throughout the galaxy. So we decided to pair the posters, which make you feel like you're an interstellar traveler from the future returning back from your vacation outside our solar system, with virtual reality, so that you feel like you could stand on the surface of an exoplanet and look up and see what the sky would look like from an alien world.
And so on the website, and I don't have it up right now, but I was checking it out earlier, you can visit these exoplanets. And tell me about, like, you know, what you would expect the experience to be like for users. You can use your smartphone or your laptop, and you can also use VR goggles, right?
Yes. So the experience works, like you said, both on a laptop and on a phone. And if you have a cardboard, like a Google Cardboard or another brand, you can pop your phone in and it'll work so that you have a three-dimensional view. And when you get to the website, it gives you a selection of six exoplanets from we found over 3,700 planets, but we chose these six because we think they're really exciting. And it gives you a gallery of all the posters, so you can choose to download a poster for yourself, or for three of them, you can feel what it would be like to be in a virtual reality simulation of being on a possible representation of that planet.
Well, let's go through them one by one because they're really fun. So let's start with the first one, the one that's based on the TRAPPIST-1 E poster that I have. And that kind of shows some little kids, like a family looking out a window as they're, I don't know, either arriving or leaving this planet. So could you maybe describe that a little bit for us?
Yeah, that's actually my favorite because I got to work so closely on it. So TRAPPIST-1 E gives you sort of this twilight world where you see all the colors in these purples and reds, and that's because this is one of seven planets around a cool red star. So in fact, the light would look red to our eyes. Another cool thing about this planet is that it has a day side and a night side. So there actually is a twilight zone where the day side of the planet meets the night side, because the planet doesn't rotate like Earth does. So it's fixed, kind of like our moon, with one side facing its star and one away.
So, ooh, that's interesting that there's a real twilight zone, not just like the epic sci-fi television show from the early 1960s. Tell us a bit about the twilight zone on this planet.
The twilight zone is the place where the day side of the planet and the night side of the planet meet. So it's this area where the light always looks like the sun is setting, but you also have this collision of temperatures from the coldness of the night side and the heat of the day side. So in the poster, you can see that there's ice forming on the water that the family is looking at outside the window. You can also see that there's a city in the distance and it's lit up like it's nighttime because it's sort of dim. And I think one of my favorite details is that up in the sky on one of the other planets in the system, you can also see the lights of another city.
Wow. So there's, and of course, this is all using your imagination. This is not, you know, real, but it's based on real science.
Exactly. So it's not real that people could go there because it's light years away from us. It's 39 light years away. We would all be, you know, way past ancient. We wouldn't exist anymore by the time we got there. But we did collaborate with both the artists and the scientists to see if you could visibly see the lights of a city on another planet from the surface of TRAPPIST-1E. And in even though it's an imaginative exercise, the distances are correct that you would be able to look up and that other city would be visible if you could stand there.
Wow. And tell me a bit about the artists that you collaborated with. How did you recruit them? Where did they come from to do this? Because they have this beautiful artwork.
It really is. It has this beautiful vintage feel. And I think the best part is that these artists work for NASA. They're Jet Propulsion Laboratory artists. They work in an art studio here among the scientists and the engineers. And so we all collaborate together. So I sat with both the graphic artists and the scientists in a room together, and we all talked about what these posters should look like. So science and art, in that respect, aren't separate from each other. They actually inform one another in the Travel Bureau.
That is so cool. I could just imagine, you know, someone running into one of them at a party and saying, "So, yeah, what do you do?" "Well, I'm an artist for NASA." I mean, it doesn't get any cooler than that.
Yeah, and I especially love telling kids at events we go to that, you know, if you love to draw or if you love to paint a picture with words, that doesn't mean that you can't be part of space exploration, because NASA is looking for people who write and people who do videos and people who do art as well as the scientists and engineers.
And then, of course, you can explore further by going to TRAPPIST-1D, where you can get this virtual reality experience. And I'm looking at it right now. It's very interesting. It's kind of creepy looking red sky and rocks. And then you can kind of click on things, and you can click on things in the sky, the other exoplanets, and it tells you information about them. Tell us a bit about all the work that had to go into putting that virtual reality component together, where you get this 360 exploration of the planet.
It was a pretty fantastic collaboration that actually took months to put together, because what we did was we talked to the discoverers of the system, the TRAPPIST-1 system. So the shade of red that you're looking at was very carefully calculated based off of the data that we have about the starlight from that planet and what it might look like if it was reflecting off of a hypothetical atmosphere. So it's very unnerving looking, but I remember sitting in a meeting with the scientist Sarah Seeger, and she was describing to us that it would look like if you walked into a dark room and you only had red light bulbs in there, everything would appear red. And the same goes for the other planets in the system, which you can see in the sky. Those, we calculated how big they would appear from the surface based off of the distances and orbits of the planets from each other. And the rocky surface that you stand on is based off of the density of the planet, which we calculated off of its mass and radius. So it's taking an imaginative leap from the data that we got from our Spitzer Space Telescope and ground observatories.
And there's even a pool of hypothetical water in the foreground. So I'm thinking, you know, you could take your hypothetical fly rod and maybe see if you could catch some hypothetical fish.
Yes, I like the label hypothetical water. So this TRAPPIST-1D and TRAPPIST-1E are both planets in the habitable zone of their sun. So that means that they could have the right conditions for water. However, if they don't have an atmosphere, then much like Mars, we wouldn't find any water there. And honestly, we're not sure what we would see on the surface. But we have future missions that are coming up. We have TESS, which just launched in April, and the James Webb Space Telescope, which will launch in a couple years. And those missions are dedicated to getting some of the answers to these questions we have, which are, do these planets have atmospheres? And if they have atmospheres, could that protect water on the surface of the planet?
And let's talk about some of the other interesting places. One of my favorite ones, it's very kitschy and fun, is PSO J318.5-22, where the nightlife never ends.
The rogue planet is one of my favorite planets, honestly, second only to the planet with two suns. So this is a planet that is either called free-floating or rogue, and it's the planet where the nightlife never ends because it has no star. So it's always nighttime on this planet, and that means it's also freely floating through space without an orbit.
And I love the poster. Could you describe it for our listeners, because it's really cool.
So we have people with astronaut helmets in a sort of 1920s flapper evening wear, and they're standing on this planet done in shades of dark purple so you can get a feel for the night. And they look like they're having a really wonderful time on this freezing planet that has no star at all.
It's kind of like the Great Gatsby meets outer space.
Exactly.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm your host, Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll conclude our conversation with Arielle Samuelson. She's a web manager for NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab and helps to oversee the Exoplanet Travel Bureau website. Stay with us, and thanks for listening. And we're back. Let's return to our interview with website manager Arielle Samuelson. She helps oversee the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's Exoplanet Travel Bureau. For our listeners that want to go explore this, what's the website and what's the best way to go about it if you were going to recommend to a friend how to really experience this?
So if you go to exoplanets.nasa.gov, if you look for the Exoplanet Travel Bureau, which is actually right on our front homepage, it'll take you to this page that invites you to explore the galaxy. So if you say, yes, I would like to explore the galaxy, then it'll take you to the very first poster, and you can choose to look at the surface. So I would tell a friend right away, explore the surface of this planet. Take a look around, look up, spin completely around. We put labels on everything so that we sort of tell you what you're looking at. And I would start them with the one that is nicknamed Tatooine, because I am a science fiction fan myself. So the knowledge that there are actually planets out there where you could watch a double sunset was one of the most exciting discoveries for me in this job.
And Tatooine, of course, is from Star Wars.
Yes.
I'd like to know a little bit about you and what you do. How did you, what kind of path led you to your job there at JPL doing this kind of work? Because it's really fascinating.
I was always interested in space, I think, because it's so omnipresent. When you look up at the stars, you can't help but wonder what else is out there. So I always wanted to know, you know, if there were other planets, if there were other beings out there, as a very young child, which is how I got into science fiction. I think it's also a family affair. So my grandfather worked on the Gemini program for NASA in Houston, and I wanted to follow in his footsteps and become an astronaut. But I was much more interested in writing than I was in doing physics. So I really dedicated myself to journalism. And little did I know that actually by following a path of journalism would actually lead me to working in space in the area that I love the most. So when I was getting my master's degree in journalism at the University of Southern California, I had a classmate who worked on climate change at the Jet Propulsion Lab. And she told me that there was an opening for an internship with the exoplanet program. So I crossed my fingers a lot, and I was so excited that I tried to play it very cool in the interviews, and I eventually got the job.
And how long have you been there?
I've worked here for 3 years.
So give me your over cocktails or elevator speech, you know, when somebody asks you what you do, how do you describe that to them?
I say that I get to tell people about all the exciting things that NASA is discovering beyond our solar system. I get to be the one who talks to the scientists and the engineers, and then I get to go and tell the public about what we found, because really this information belongs to everyone. So I get to use social media, use the web, use videos and graphics and any sort of article that we might want to write to reach people and tell them about the wonderful discoveries we found.
And the other planets that you can visit. So how many planets, exoplanets are there on the website now?
So there are over 3,730 exoplanets, and you can look at all of them because we have a minute-by-minute exoplanet counter that actually ticks upward when we find a new planet. And for the Travel Bureau, we chose a select few, but you can go through every single one if you'd like to.
And how many are there on the Travel Bureau now?
There are 6 exoplanets. They sort of range between gas giants to Earth-sized planets, and we're hoping to add more in the future.
One of my favorite ones is the Super Earth. I think it's HD40307G, and it looks like it's a skydiver, and you're probably getting a pretty high acceleration skydive on a world like that.
Yes, he's on a Super Earth, which this particular Super Earth has twice the volume of Earth. So it has gravity that's at least twice as strong as Earth's gravity. So this skydiver is doing some extreme skydiving.
And what kind of feedback have you gotten so far from like people, and especially have kids enjoy this?
They absolutely are amazed by looking at a planet that looks like ours because it has a sky and it has a ground, but everything is slightly different. So you have 2 suns in the sky instead of 1, or you have a red sky instead of a blue sky. And I think the most rewarding part is when these exoplanets become real to people. They're not just a concept or a set of data. They become a visualization that you can feel a part of and let your imagination place you there.
Also, before I let you go, just a little bit curious, have you ever checked out the video on YouTube for the a cappella science station where they do A Whole New World from Aladdin?
I think so. I know a couple of people did TRAPPIST-1 songs. Does it do a TRAPPIST-1 song?
At the very end, they mentioned TRAPPIST-1. If as an exoplanet person working on those and doing what you do, I urge you to check that out. It's a wonderful song. It's a fantastic music video based on A Whole New World from Aladdin. And it's a history of exoplanet exploration from the very first exoplanet, Pegasi 51b, I believe it was, to the TRAPPIST system discovery.
That's fantastic. I love it when people participate in the science, and I will definitely check that out.
Oh, it's good. You'll really like it. And tell all your friends there if they haven't seen it. I think they'll really enjoy it.
I will. I'll pass it around.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to tell us about this before we let you go? What's coming up in the future for this website and the Travel Bureau?
So the first discoveries of exoplanets are just a little over 20 years old. So for us, we expect that TESS particularly will bring back so many new discoveries that we're going to be filling the Travel Bureau with possible new planets. And I think our dream is to let people imagine themselves on as many diverse worlds as we discover.
And we should also mention, I think we did before, but if anybody wants to download these beautiful posters, like for teachers for their classrooms or for your dorm room or for just, you know, wherever you want to put one, they can do that, right?
Yes, the posters are free to download. So anyone can download them and print them out. And they're available on our website in both, you know, web resolution, and you can get a really high resolution so you can make a really beautiful full-size wall poster.
Yeah, they're gorgeous, and thanks so much for providing those for us, because it makes it a fun way to get kids to use their imaginations to think about the science behind all this.
Thank you.
And for all of us, for that matter. Yeah, thank you, Ariel. I really appreciate your time today, and good best of luck with your career there and the Exoplanet Travel Bureau.
Thank you very much.
Ariel Samuelson, she helps oversee the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's Exoplanet Travel Bureau website. You know, I was thinking about, it's interesting to speculate about alien life forms, but there are plenty of examples of strange living things on our own planet. As a kid, I was fascinated by the phosphorescent plankton that would light up the ocean at my sister's Malibu home. And I was recently thinking about what a strange thing that was, to see the surf lit up by a myriad of creatures too small to see at night. So I asked our friend Cheryl Hosler about this phenomenon. She's the roving naturalist, and she looked into the phenomenon of bioluminescence, living things that light up. Here's her report.
A small light flashes in the dark. If you're standing in a field or forest, it could be a lightning bug. If you're on the beach, it might be plankton in the waves. And if you're lucky enough to be in a deep-sea submersible, it could be the lure of an anglerfish. But regardless of the setting, life finds a way to light up the darkness. Creatures from all across the tree of life create light through a process called bioluminescence. Light is released from a chemical reaction involving two important chemicals, luciferase and luciferin, and their interaction with oxygen. Luciferase and luciferin are generic placeholder names for two groups of chemicals that are often organism-specific. Luciferase is an enzyme that catalyzes the oxidation of luciferin in an organism. Energy released from the reaction escapes in the form of light. Bioluminescence is sometimes called phosphorescence because, historically, scientists thought it was caused by large amounts of phosphorus in the bodies of animals. E. Newton Harvey disproved this theory in favor of the luciferin-luciferase reaction in the early 1900s. Dr. Harvey sought to prove that all bioluminescent life had evolved from a common ancestor, but instead his research showed a wide variety of chemical compositions for luciferins and luciferases, which indicates that bioluminescence has evolved independently at least 40 times in a process called convergent evolution. Bacteria, plankton, fungi, sea jellies, worms, insects, and crustaceans are the most common groups of organisms showcasing bioluminescence, although there are also around 1,500 species of fish that can bioluminesce. However, many of these fish species, including flashlight fish and the ever-popular anglerfish, actually produce light from colonies of bioluminescent bacteria living on their bodies. Flashlight fish have a specialized pocket under their eyes that provides a home for their symbiotic bioluminescent bacteria, while the bacteria on an anglerfish live on its lure. What good is a light-up lure on the end of your face if you're an anglerfish? There isn't a whole lot of light in the deep ocean, and most of what does exist down there is produced by living things. So the bright light on the end of an anglerfish's lure is a great way to attract smaller fish who are looking for a meal. Unfortunately for those fish fooled by the lure, they wind up becoming a meal instead. Attracting prey is just one of many functions bioluminescence can serve. Light-up body parts can also be used to attract mates, scare away predators either by warning them about a toxic taste or by surprising them with a bright flash, mimic another species to gain one of these benefits, communicate with members of your own species, or act as counter-illumination against a bright background for camouflage purposes. There's even an evolutionary arms race over the color of light in the deep ocean, where much of the competition over bioluminescence occurs. Since red light has the longest wavelength, it's much less likely to reach into very deep waters as opposed to green or blue light. This means that animals with red pigments in their skin will be much harder to see in the darkness of the deep ocean. Think about anglerfish, vampire squid, and many deep water shrimp and crabs. They're all red. However, some predators have capitalized on the popularity of this color in deep ocean fashion. Dragonfish in the family Stomiidae can produce red light from bioluminescent patches on their faces that allow them to detect red-colored prey in the darkness. closer to the surface of the ocean, you may be familiar with the idea of mareel, also called milky seas, where the tops of waves or disturbed areas of water take on a bright blue glow that, when in a large enough patch, can even be seen from space. Mareel is usually attributed to an organism called sea sparkle, which is a dinoflagellate, a kind of marine plankton in the genus Noctiluca. While large blooms of algae can produce toxins that make the water dangerous for humans and wildlife, dinoflagellates actually eat algal blooms and don't produce any toxins of their own. However, blooms of sea sparkle can build up large amounts of ammonia as they digest algae, so there are still some rare cases of toxicity for fish. Bioluminescence occurs in terrestrial ecosystems as well. Fireflies, also known as lightning bugs, communicate with potential mates by lighting up their abdomens. The pattern and duration of flashes indicates the species of firefly present. But how do fireflies turn the light on and off? Scientists recently discovered that fireflies are able to control the flow of oxygen into the reaction chamber in their bodies where bioluminescence occurs. When oxygen is allowed in, the luciferase causes the luciferin to oxidize and release light. When the oxygen supply is cut off, the reaction stops and the firefly goes dark. Something else besides fireflies might be glowing in the woods nearby. Have you ever heard of foxfire? This is a very old term for the false fire, or light generated by some damp, dead wood. The eerie glow is actually caused by any one of several different kinds of fungi. Scientists suggest that fungi and mushrooms bioluminesce in order to attract insects. Once a curious insect lands on a mushroom, it will unknowingly pick up spores and carry them to new places for the fungus to colonize. Bioluminescence has fascinated people for centuries, and now we're trying to imitate it through biomimetic technology. Some researchers are working on genetically engineering glowing trees that could serve as streetlights in place of lamps that require electricity. Can you imagine having bioluminescent light bulbs in your home? There are also medical uses for bioluminescence, including creating light-up markers to indicate specific parts of brains or strands of DNA. The next time you see a tiny light in the dark forest or ocean, think of the oxidation reaction between luciferin and luciferase. Bioluminescence allows animals, fungi, and bacteria to light up our world.
Thank you, Cheryl Hosler. You can check out her YouTube channel, The Roving Naturalist. And thanks again to our exoplanet expert guests, Eric Mamajek, Deputy Project Scientist for NASA's Exoplanet Exploration Program at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, and Ariel Samuelson, Web Manager for JPL's Exoplanet Travel Bureau. You can re-listen to or share this program as well as past episodes at mynspr.org. You can subscribe to our podcast on NPR Podcasts and iTunes or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow me on Twitter at Dave Schloem. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot. And there may be many others.